Welcome to the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. We are your hosts, Martijn Bron and Alexander Sterk.
Hello, everybody. Welcome, listeners, to yet another episode of the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. And I'm very happy to have our guest today, Rob Gosman. I haven't seen for 20 years, and now I see him again. I see that life has been good to him. That's great. The life of a trader can be good. And it's the second commodity trader who is an expert in trading energy, trading oil. So that's also quite interesting that we cover that. Now, let me introduce how I got to know Rob. That was in the early 2000s in Geneva. I worked for Cargill in Geneva from 2003 to 2006. And then I also got to know lots of new people. And in Geneva, there was a large contingent of English traders. And so I got to know Rob. And I must say that in the beginning, when I came from Holland and then to Geneva, I found the place quite intimidating. And also on the social side, I didn't know anything about cricket. I didn't know anything about rugby. But I came to appreciate that, watching that with, you know, Rob and other friends. So that is how I got to know Rob. How did we figure out inviting Rob for the podcast? We wanted to do something about energy. And then I talked to my friend and also a former podcast guest, Ivo Sojanovic, and he said, look, you should invite Gosman. So we did. So we're here.
It sounds like a good one, Rob. So you can tell us all about the world of trading and especially on the energy side, perhaps. Welcome. And I think everybody looks forward to hearing your introduction.
First off, thanks for inviting me on the podcast. This is my first, so I apologize in advance, but it's a very privileged thing to be able to do. My name is Rob Gosman. I've been a trader for about 30 years. I studied economics at university before joining Cargill Trading Division on the graduate scheme all the way back in 1995. I started in Lincoln in the UK, working on the wheat desk, buying and selling barges of wheat in and around the UK. And over my cargo career, which spanned about 11 years, I traded wheat, canola and gasoline products in the UK, Paris and Geneva. Following my time at Cargill, I took a year's sabbatical and ended up joining BP in around 2006, initially as a gasoline derivatives trader, which is the paper side of the business. But then I was asked to become the global commodity head, which is basically someone who oversees a bunch of traders trading all light ends of the barrel, so gasoline, chemicals, ethanol, and using the information we get from those trades to speculate on global markets. I held that role for around 11 years before I retired at the end of 21 at the ripe old age of 48.
That's great. A fantastic career.
First question, why didn't you continue trading? Because it's such an amazing job that everybody found. So,
well, I haven't stopped, if I'm honest. I do a lot of trading for myself now. It's more a case of being a trader but not going to an office. I manage my own personal portfolio. I still track the energy markets and trade the energy markets. So what I realized actually when I retired is that I'll always be a trader. It's just a question of how and why and when I do it. And having a young family, I was very fortunate to be able to make that decision to give some more time to them and still do the thing that I clearly love and will do to the very day I die.
I'm interested very much in, like, how do you then, because at the BP, at a Cargill, you have all the information, you have all the whole teams, etc. So how is trading then by yourself? How is that you don't have all these eyes and ears in the market?
Well, I've got 30 years of contacts in the markets, and some of those people are the very best traders in the industry. So they keep me on the straight and narrow. I do my research. I sensor check stuff with them. Very kindly give me steers as to when to stay out of trouble, whether my logic is sound or flawed. So I do talk to people and I also trade in a different way. I think when you're in an office and you're trading and you have a lot of risk to deploy, there's a kind of onus to actually deploy it. I now have the luxurious position of being able to deploy risk only when the stars aligned and I feel very, very confident. So it's not the same number of trades going on. They're much more timed, they're much more specific, and like I said, backed by both researched myself and having a network of people who are some of the best in the business. Either they are retired or still working.
Thanks, Rob. So that means that you went from the agricultural side at a Cargill, wheat, canola, et cetera, towards more even the paper and then energy side. How is that going from one side to the other side in this trading?
It was a huge cultural shock, to be honest. I mean, what you don't realize when you grow up trading in a large system such as Cargill is the sheer amount of energy and access to information that you have. And I think it's something you take for granted if you don't know any different. And I think that was the biggest culture shock when I moved into the oil department within Cargill. It was very much a niche business, very asset light. We didn't have the access to the information. We didn't have any refinery access. We had limited shipping understanding. We had fledgling analytics. And we really had to work extremely hard to try and level the playing field between us and the behemoths, the oil equivalent of Cargill in the oil markets, the BPs, the Texcos, the Shells, the Vitols, the Trafigura's and Glencore's.
Thanks.
So let me go back a bit to the beginning, because a lot of people in the audience, they're very young. I get also a lot of requests from people, how do I break into the industry? If you look at your start, and could you describe, because now clearly after 30 years, you say, well, that's something I'm really passionate about. It comes natural. And there's something you really want to do. But when you're young, how do you know that? And how did you feel like after your studies that you felt like, yeah, trading or financial markets, that's my interest? That's the first question. And then how did you get to Cargill? And most people have never heard about that company.
First of all, I didn't even know what commodity trading was when I was at university. And I enjoyed risk. I enjoyed investing. I enjoyed putting myself in harm's way with regard to a portfolio of risk, but I never really understood that you could do that outside of banking. And that's where initially I showed my interest going into the banking sector. Again, you know, for all your listeners out there who think they have to have an amazing plan age 20, I'm not sure that's the case. I think it's very dangerous to think you know what you want to do, because until you start doing it, you have no idea whether it suits you. I'm actually quite embarrassed by how I ended up at Cargill, because I applied to a number of banks relatively well. I applied to Cargill, and on the application form, it was generic. So it was a generic application form, and at the top of the form, it had three boxes to tick. And it says, do you want to do trading, HR, or accounting? And so I sent the application form off together with hundreds of other ones to many, many banks and different organizations. And when I went for the interview, I sat down, a guy called Doug King, who you may have remember, actually interviewed me at the time. And, you know, there's me, a fresh-faced, 19, 20-year-old guy. And he says, why are you good for this job? And I'd forgotten which box I'd ticked, right? So I told him, I said, I like people and I like numbers and I like risk. And he stopped for a second and he said to me, you don't know which box you ticked. And I said, I've got to be honest, I don't. And he said, I'll put you down as trader. And that was the first step on a 30-year career.
Amazing. You could have been in HR, you could have been an accountant, but hey, went for the trading.
And this is also one of the things, that you need to be honest. That's one of the things. When I interview youngsters and I raise a question and I see that they do not know the answer, I always say, look, just tell me you don't know. Don't bullshit me. But maybe Rob has a different view, because I think that, Rob, maybe you were a gambler. Maybe that was how you felt as a young person, that you were attracted to risk. And I also know one of our former colleagues, Gavin Johns, who betted on dog racing. And the discussion I had with our former podcast guest at Turner was about Mandara Trading, where they hired a lot of poker players, and he was one himself. Now, was that something that you did in which you feel like, hey, at a young age, you can identify people who like risk and probability and risk management is gone? Yeah, there you are.
So I think you can identify people who like risk. Whether you can identify people who can trade, I don't think that's as easy. I have hired probably over 100 people in my career, and some people who I thought were bang on, absolutely going to make it, didn't. And some people learnt the trade, had the fundamentals, but learned the trade and went on to be extremely successful traders. So you can have the traits, But you've got to have the, you know, when it comes down to it, you've got to be able to pull the trigger. You've got to be able to do the things. You've got to be able to question yourself. You've got to be able to listen. You've got to be able to learn. You've got to be able to fail. And I think a lot of people coming out of university haven't really been tested like that. And I think today we'll probably talk a lot about failure and mistakes, because I believe they are instrumental in learning to trade. And how you manage failure is critical to how successful you'll be as a long-term trader. I always think that mistakes aren't mistakes if you learn from them. They're actually investments.
Then if you look at that, you know, if you look at the teams, right, and the people that you hired, and you hired a lot of people, and I think you had over 50 people in the BP team. Was there a lot of rotation in that team? Was it difficult to hire these people? Was it difficult to find them? It took you a long time to create a successful team?
Well, in BP, there is a huge graduate program and a very rigorous one. They come in, they do, it's hugely competed. They have to do trading games to actually get through the door. They then do 3 years rotation on the desk. So they get to see operations and shipping and accountancy and risk. And in those jobs, they get access to the desks and we get to see them. They send a trading course for 4 days, which someone like me will judge on. If they pass that, then they go off to selection for the desk. So the vast majority of people coming on the desk were homegrown talent. We tried to change that and have changed that in the last few years, because I strongly believe that if you grow up in one environment, as I said earlier about Cargill and the huge behemoth of a machine that you're in, if you only know that machine, you assume everyone else knows the same things you do, has the same life experiences you do, and they don't. And I think people have come from external hire typically have a fresh perspective. And I found that when I joined BP, it was that fresh perspective that really helped me get hold of what was going on. I'll give you an example. When I used to be a cog in the oil business, we used to go into a market meeting and there'd be about six people in there, a crude trader, a gasoline trader, a distillate trader, an analyst, a manager. And my first day at BP, I walked into a market meeting, there were 32 people. There were six analysts. Every refinery we owned was represented. There was a trader from every part of the barrel. And I sat down that day and I thought to myself, if I can't make money, given all this information, then I shouldn't be a trader. And the rest is history.
I recognize that in a different market, in a niche market, a market that I traded cocoa. But yeah, you realize being present in supply chains is critical and having really good access to information of both the suppliers and the demand, and then also have the ability to capture data and to have it accessible and to analyze it. Now, that's also one of the things that if you look at the last couple of years, maybe decades, how access to data and technology has changed. You know, when you and I were in Geneva, we had in essence every trader making their own S&D, and that was Excel based. And then we had a system, you recall it, was Macbeth, right? It was basically a tool where you can upload your Excel, and you had Dave Cyrus the Virus, who would chase everyone to update their S&D, okay? But that thing was very static. Now, what have you experienced in BP, and have you been instrumental yourself to really develop a much more contemporary system, so enabled by technology, so that you have access to and live access, spot access to all that information? Or have you also been in BP traded basis, kind of the old school S&D analysis?
Well, we're very fortunate when I was at BP to have best-in-class analytics. I personally didn't get involved in the creation of the S&Ds. What the job of the traders really was to feed the analysts real-time information as to what they were seeing and hearing in the market. And the bit of the S&Ds that I did get involved in was how to allow the traders to better access those in real time. So I'm not an IT boffin, and I certainly don't understand what goes on behind the screen, but it was about having good analysts who could explain what they were seeing, what the data was telling them, and what was likely to happen in the future, and then having access for the traders so they could go into the system and fiddle around with it, change the assumptions, and see what the outcomes look like. So the trader interaction was much more about verifying the assumptions of the analytics and having the ability to stretch those analytic assumptions. But I'll say again, people that worked for me on the gasoline desk were absolutely phenomenal.
What were they so good at?
I'll give you an example of how important they were. I sat in the middle of the desk in London. There was about 20 odd traders, and the analyst sat one seat removed from me. That's how ingrained he was in the desk. That was the key gasoline analyst. And he would literally sit there and listen to every conversation, every trade, every chat across the desk, every, you know, hear snippets of a phone call, and he would pick up on it. And he put the phone down. And he said, did he just say X, Y, and Z? And all that would get fed into this mighty machine. It was that interaction, that inclusion within the desk. These were not people who were parked a long way away and were feeding us sheets of information that we could choose or choose not to act upon. These were people who were integrated into the desk and were some of the most important people we had.
And if you, this is also how you can educate me, Erwin and Alex, I think. When you talk about the oil majors, you usually talk about BP, Shell, Chevron, yeah? But they are different than, for example, Trafigura, Vito, Mercuria, and Glencore. How do you compare those different companies, and what are the different edges? And then, well, how did you look at them?
Well, when I got to BP, the vast majority of the money that was being made was by asset trading, by understanding the flows, by the optionality, the ingrained optionality that some of those portfolios generated. What we were not so good at, on the light-hands desk at least, was monetizing that in the derivative markets. And I think what happens in these large companies, some have gone faster than others, some haven't really gone at all. But what happened in BP was we realized there was huge sums of money to be made by taking what we knew in the markets, taking what we were learning, and then leveraging that knowledge within the derivative markets. And we pushed that agenda very, very strongly. We kept building the physical portfolio. We kept growing the oil base, which is necessary. But one of the biggest growth areas was in the derivative trading, which is where I was brought in to do. On the VTOL and the Trafigura side, I think it's interesting, they've almost come the opposite way. They started off heavily in the derivative space, light on assets. And in the last 10 years, they've realized that with the complexity of the market growing, having, you know, physical assets which engender optionality and provide information on flows and give you a credibility in the market is increasingly important. So you're actually seeing the likes of VTOL and Trafigura do huge investments in asset bases across the oil complex. And are now some, you know, that they really have, and they're very strategic assets as well. So an oil company typically will grow organically where they see an opportunity to refine oil, that's where they'll do it. A trading company will often look for an asset that has trading optionality around it, and that'll be the first and foremost point of their decision to buy that asset. So they come at it from very much a trading angle, whereas oil companies typically come from the asset perspective. And we're finding now that we're sort of bumping into each other a lot more because VTOL looks a lot more like BP than it ever did, and BP probably looks a little bit more VTOL than it ever did.
It's a very interesting discussion, because we've talked about it before when we explained the difference between paper trading or derivatives trading versus merchandising, and the term that was always used in cargo to trade around assets. And is that when you came in BP that you realized that the setup, the way we had in cargo was vulnerable and didn't give a sufficient edge?
In the oil business?
Yeah.
I think there was a time whereby you could, when oil markets were relatively undeveloped and the participants were not very mature in the trading space, whereby a trader with a good idea could approach a oil major and take some oil from them, pay a decent price for it, within that purchase, get some optionality, which they would then monetize. And the oil major probably wouldn't really understand what they were doing and how they were monetizing it, but they did know they were getting a decent price for their oil. Over time, these oil majors, just as we did in BP, became much more aware of the derivative opportunity around that. It became much more sophisticated in how to monetize that barrel. We understood the optionality in a portfolio and therefore either wouldn't sell to a trading organization or would do at such an exorbitant price that it became unprofitable for them. So I think there was a time back in early 2000s where there was money to insert a generic trading organization into complex that involved large majors. I don't think that's the case anymore. I don't think you just cannot get hold of oil at anything like a decent price because there were hundreds of traders out there who are competing for that oil. So I think that model has gone. And I think if you are going to be long-term successful in this space, you have to grow an asset base. You have to have a reason to exist. Otherwise, you'll find that there's huge dark corners in the world that you don't understand and know about, and you'll get caught.
But then that reduces the amount of players that can actually be in the market, but it also means that maybe one asset is not even enough, right? If you say you need dark, you need to know the information and it has dark places, but then you one asset on one side of the world doesn't tell you on the other side of the world. So is that then reducing the amount of players and you need more than one asset maybe? Is that what you're saying in models?
I think it does reduce the amount of players. You have to understand that, you know, there are companies that operate in very different jurisdictions. You've seen from the Ukraine war, you know, a huge change in the flows around the world. You've seen a difference in the Russian flows. You know, they moved from the west to the east. You've seen barrels moving to South America, a lot of which a lot of people wouldn't touch. And you're finding there is companies that operate which a company, a large multinational major, might not want to be involved in that flow. So you are seeing these be dominated by typically smaller companies, some of which don't hang around very long. But it's still quite fragmented. But if you go on the standardized trade routes, the ones that you see Europe to the US, that is saturated by large multinationals. And you don't see these small companies trading in it because they simply can't operate.
What I always like is some concrete examples. So what I always find interesting is to ask a professional trader about something that a novice in a specific market or retail, let me put it that way, has seen, and then hear from you how you experience that. And if I look at the crude oil market, one of the most interesting and recent things that we have seen was crude oil, the spot market going to negative during the COVID period. Could you describe with us how you experienced that?
I think it's safe to say, after done this for 30 years, that 3 months around COVID was probably the most horrible 3 months of my trading career. Taking you back before COVID, you have to understand that the market looked extremely good, extremely tight. There's huge shortages looming in the Q2, Q3 period. And we were very sure that the market was going to go bonkers. We had filled up every tank, every ship, were limit long derivatives. We had every risk metric. More than that, that's not quite right, because we did. This is before, you know, COVID sort of reared its ugly head. So we were well set to really benefit from a very tight market. COVID started to grow, concerns started to grow, reduced positions, but still the physical exposure was still huge. And then on the fateful day that the world changed forever, prices just collapsed in a manner that I had never seen before. And the information flow around the world was so fragmented. It was quite a terrifying time because the rule book had been thrown out the window. So we were losing money hand over fist. The refineries were screaming at us because I'm not sure if you understand. When the COVID first hit, crude oil prices collapsed. And product prices remained relatively strong. So the refinery margin was extremely good. And the refineries were desperate to run as fast as possible. And one of our roles was to move the products as they were producing them. But of course, when all your tanks are full and all your ships are full, your ability to do so is. So we had the fight of our lives, not only trading the derivatives market and trying to keep it orderly and functional and rational, desperate not to be selling the lows of the market, which got lower and lower every day. But on the other side, you know, fulfill our logistical commitments to the customer, both the customer in terms of our refineries and the customers that needed the oil. And often logistics just simply meant we couldn't discharge. Ships were floating, you know, in the middle of the Atlantic with nothing to do. And it was really quite a terrifying time for everyone because it was such an unknown. And it really did test the mettle of all the traders in the market, myself included. And we all came out of it learning an awful lot about black swan events, about how to deal with positions, difficult timings, mistakes, if you want to call it mistake. I struggle with the word mistake because that suggests you've done something wrong. The world shifted on you and it's about reacting to it. And that's when you really see the good traders from the bad. Everyone looks good when the market's going up. Everyone looks good and behaves well when the market's going up and they're doing well. But really find out about somebody is when the arse falls out of the market and they are looking at you and you're looking at them, and between you, you have to sort it out. This is not an option. It's not a, you can't leave it. You've got to get it done. And I really found out a lot about myself and the training team in that time. And most of what I found out was good. And I look back on that time and I come out in cold sweats, but I think it was one of the key lessons and makings of the group that I ended up leaving, because we became together over something that was really difficult. We came out the other side. We ended up the year making a lot of money. We serviced the assets. We found a way. We turned over rocks. We just did everything we could in our power. The refineries kept running. The customers were served as best we could with the logistical constraints, which were outside of our control. But it really was a traumatic time and something that I'll never forget.
You know, if you look at what you said, right, the world changed and you were long. And do you think that traders now should, or maybe already have, and, you know, purchasers in general, have a different way of pre-COVID, post-COVID managing risk? Do you think that is now done completely different because people are afraid that a black swan event like that could happen again?
Yeah, I think the risk metrics and the risk processes have definitely improved. I mean, tell you how old I am. We used to look at risk in terms of how many barrels you had on the book. When I was at Cargill, that's how we did it. You had a million barrels of on the book, and that was risk. What we did, the risk profiles improved. We moved to an MVAR model, which is the monetary value at risk. So rather than look at the absolute barrels you've got on the book, they look at the historical price action of those barrels and backdate it to see what you could have possibly lost over the last 90 days. Now, post-COVID, and even prior to that, they then had, you know, tail risk event losses, and you could look, therefore, at catastrophic loss and what it would mean. So I think risk processes have improved immeasurably. I think if, and especially in some of these shops such as Citadel and places like that, you'll find risk is first and foremost, almost before anything else. And whilst it's increasingly becoming like that in places like, you know, BP, I think the historical risk models were very poor and failed to really show what loss could look like. And I think if nothing else, COVID taught us that, you know, these black swan events, when they come, they can be pretty big black swans. And it seems to me, and I don't know if I'm just getting old, there's more black swans than white swans these days. And we have to get better and have to get more thought on the implications of these huge events in the market. But on the flip side of that, you know, you can't scare yourself into a corner of only running a certain amount of risks because these outliers might be there. Because, you know, you could always make an awful lot of money in a more normalized market, forgo an awful lot of earning because you're forever terrified of the tail risk. You know, what we're getting better at is actually building strategies around that tail risk. So whether that be option strategies or directional strategies that mean you're not necessarily so exposed to the tail risk, but you can still take material risk in volatile markets.
A lot of the agri side traders, they say, well, we are not, many of the agri markets are not as mature, not as professional, maybe not as far ahead as the energy side of the trading side. That's what I often hear. Is it then different managing risk? You have done both sides in the energy side than in the agri side.
Well, it was a long time since I've been an agri trader, but I do seem to remember that you had these kind of year-long cycles. You had a lot of wind-up into harvest periods. You would have a lot of data about how the crop was looking, expectations about crop size, and the market fluctuations would then occur. And then when the crop was pretty much brought in, it was all about the demand side of the equation and what demand might look like. And that, and it was quite one-sided. It was all about production for 3 months of the year. Then it seemed to be all about demand for 9 months of the year. And then the whole cycle would start again. What I find fascinating about the oil markets, especially in the product markets, is that you have the ability at the refinery level to toggle between production of different products. You can change the yield on a refinery or a unit. And that means that price action relatively quickly can affect how the yields come out at the refinery level. And therefore, you can affect both the demand and the supply in the oil markets. And I think that's what makes the Mendelssohn interesting, is that there's so many different elements to price determination. I mean, many people on this call won't understand. Gasoline is not a thing. It's not a product. It's a blended product. You can make it in a myriad of different ways. It can have chemicals coming in from the chemical pool. It can have different low-octane components, and many of which you've never even heard of. And throughout the time of production, we have to continually look at all these diverse markets. And that's why in BP, you have a light ends division as opposed to a gasoline division, where we had the chemical complex, we had the naphtha complex, we had the ethanol complex, and we had the gasoline trading all under the same roof. Because each one of those elements of the complex could radically affect the valuations in the other.
I find it a super interesting thought. And I have to admit that I haven't thought about it like that. Contrary to eggs, where the yield is fixed, in this space, the yield isn't fixed. So you can have much more optionality in how you switch the yield. I find that that's an interesting one.
But you mean that because the yield is then because of they could release more oil?
Yeah, so basically, look, if you crush a soybean, you can't decide how much meal and oil comes out of it. And the same for cocoa. You can't make one without the other.
What's under the ground you can take?
And you have, in the energy space, you do have the optionality to make one without the other. That's
limited optionality.
Yeah, okay,
but 1 or 2% of refinery across a lot of refineries. And let's understand, this isn't a choice for a trader to make. These assets are run as assets to be as effective as possible. What the trader needs to try and understand is what the assets around the world might be doing and the implication that will have on fundamental flows. Now, of course, they can talk to their assets and get the insight into a particular asset, but any particular asset might have their own set of criteria as to why and when they change. It could depend on the crude slate. It could depend on their commitments within their domestic pipeline. So every refinery is different, but it was for us and the analysts to try and dig down into, okay, if you get a huge spike in prices, how rapidly can refineries change their behavior? How rapidly can the consumer change their behavior? Because again, in the ag markets, the consumption, of course, it varies. But when you get price fluctuations in the valuation of gasoline, for instance, in the US, the consumer can choose not to drive. The consumer can choose to put $10 of gasoline in his car every time. He doesn't really understand that he's getting less gasoline if the prices are high and more if it's low. But the consumer's behavior is much more reactive in gasoline markets, especially gasoline markets that are not highly taxed. And therefore, the underlying flat price is translated quite quickly to the consumer price.
Rob, did you know that we tracked on the cocoa trading side, that we tracked the price of gasoline in the US because we knew that, say, at $5 a barrel or $5 a gallon, that the Americans wouldn't drive as much. And if they wouldn't drive as much, they wouldn't visit the gas station. And that would reduce a lot of impulse buying of chocolate.
Yeah.
And that led to a dramatic decline. One of the biggest declines I've ever seen in the chocolate market in 2008 when the great financial crisis hit. Because that was funny. That was still during the commodity supercycle while the world was coming to an end, right? So it was a very strange combination.
But this is the absolute beauty of markets. This is what I find endlessly fascinating. To think that oil prices could go up in Saudi Arabia and cocoa prices collapse because people are at convenience stores in Iowa, that's cool, right? Yeah. That's big data. That's the kind of stuff that if you can get your head around and you can think bigger than everyone else, that's where you can make a lot of money.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so fascinating because, you talk about a butterfly flapping its wings and a hurricane turning up in the Gulf of Mexico. The same thing happens across all the commodity markets, and they're more interlinked than we ever thought. And those link sometimes, and then they come back. And they're really clever guys. You talk about who are the best traders in the world. It's people who can see links like that before you and I.
One thing I also find fascinating in leadership behavior, and I want to go back to the story that you told about COVID, and you said, I learned a lot about myself, because on a smaller scale, because cocoa is much smaller, but I went through the exact same thing, and it was also 3 months. It was the war in Ivory Coast. And I was responsible at the time for sourcing and trading. Well, sourcing, when Ivory Coast is in a civil war, and it represents 40-50% of global supply, it's a shit house, right? So I had the 3 worst months of my career as well. But to cut the long story short, I also learned a lot from myself and from being with the best people around you. I learned there's always a solution, and I learned I can trust my judgment. And I also learned that in times of stress, people look at you. So all the youngsters, they look at what is he going to do and how is he going to behave? Now, could you share with us in those dire periods where maybe you came home and thought, well, shit, I don't want to come to the office. I mean, that is what I had at some stage because I knew the day was going to be horrible. how you dealt with coping with that enormous stress yourself and the uncertainty. And I didn't know how long that war was going to last. You didn't know how long COVID was going to last. So how did you deal with that yourself? And then seeing also the red ink in the P&L, but then staying sane and guiding and leading your team through that environment?
Well, first off, I have to say that above jumping to my leadership, I've got to give credit where credit's due to BP's leadership, because I think most of the stress that I was under was my own sense of responsibility, both to myself and the team. And I found that BP was incredibly understanding. And I think, you know, when you talk about leadership, I think one of the jobs as leaders is not to add to stress that's already there. And it's easy to say and hard to do. So when you know someone is giving it absolutely everything, shouting at them or pressurizing them or asking for reports every 20 minutes, it doesn't help. So hats off to BP management in that time. But to your point about how you felt, I remember calling a global conference with everyone in the team. And I remember going on that conference and my insides were churning and hands were sweaty and I had a myriad of notes of what I was going to say, none of which I could read properly. And I remember just saying to everyone, look, this is absolute garbage. Right? This is a dreadful situation we find ourselves in. But we've been a team for good part of 10 years, 8 years. We're very good at what we do. And if there's anybody who's going to get us out of this problem, it's going to be you lot. So take a breath, get some rest, come in tomorrow morning, and we go again. And that's what we did day after day until the thing sorted. And I think people forget that traders are people with emotions and frailties. And what they want when things are going really bad is someone to stand tall, someone who basically is a rock that you can hang on to when things go really, really wonky. And I think that's when real leaders show up, irrespective of how they feel, they are able to stand tall when everyone else needs someone to lean on.
It's extremely well articulated. Extremely well articulated. And
if you look at leadership, do you have someone that you personally, that you have a name that you would say, well, that's one that I always...
There was one guy who used to run the whole overall trading unit in BP, whose name was Paul Reed. He was an excellent manager, one of the smartest people I've ever met. He was the guy that always asked the question you didn't want him to ask. He had a very cool, calm persona, and it was impossible to bullshit him. But he was always there. He always had a good insight. He always brought calm in a room full of noise. And he had great instincts about people and markets. And if there's one person who stands out in my career as someone who really, really epitomizes what it's like to be a good leader, it would be him.
Because how would you type yourself as a trader and as a manager?
As a trader, excitable, probably is the word I would use. I don't like describing myself because anyone listening to this podcast will go, that's not the word I'd use to describe him. enthusiastic, I think. I was thinking about what makes a good leader before this conversation. I said to myself, right, someone who's passionate about what they do, right? Because I think enthusiasm is infectious. And I think the same can be said of lethargy or cynicism. I think if you're not careful, whatever you project out can taint the world. And Paul Reed always said to me, as you go up in the organization, you forget how large the shadow is that you cast. You forget how many people listen to what you say or interpret what you say or are swayed by what you say. And people always say about leaders, they should never be the first to talk in a meeting. And anyone who knows me would say, that's not you. You were always the first to talk in a meeting. And that was one of my failings. But I think people in leadership, when they show a passion for it, someone we all know, Fausto Felice, we traded for Cargill for many, many years. There's a trader who was very, very good. I hadn't got a clue how he did it, but he always had a passion for it. He always had a smile on his face. He just enjoyed the process. And I think when you surround yourself with people like that, it's very easy to get sucked into the way it works, enjoying it, growing. You know, the number of times that him and Ivan Stanovic, who was on earlier on,
Yeah.
You know, these people were in play when I was coming through. And my advice to anyone, any young traders looking to come through, if you get on the trading floor, just bug the shit out of those people. Ask them questions until they're sick of you. Buy them beers until they can't tell you any more stories. Because those are the people who will teach you things you could never learn on your own, or at least shortcut it. And I was very fortunate in Cargill to sit with some quite brilliant traders. You know, I think people have this image of traders as being sort of self-centered and selfish and brash. And in my career, at least, I've met a few of them, and some people might even say I'm one, but a majority of traders I've met are so passionate about what they do, they can't wait to talk to you about how they do it and what they do. And if you ever get the chance to go on a trading floor, or you make it onto the trading floor, just make sure that you spend time with good people who know what they're doing. And by osmosis, you will learn more than you can imagine.
When I came on that floor in Geneva, I wasn't even part of WTU, right? So I was sitting in some kind of a special desk. I was sitting across Fausto and Ivo Sorjanovic and Chris Pardee and all these guys. That's what I did, sit with them on the desk and listen to them and raise questions. And indeed, they were always very willing to help curious people. And I look back at that period with a great smile.
You asked me before what I look for in traders.
Yeah.
Right. And like I said, I've had a few. And there's two things I look for. One is hunger and the other is enthusiasm. And I always say to them, I can teach you to trade. I can't teach you to be hungry. I can't teach you to love the market. But if you do, then I can teach you to trade and then you can go somewhere. So it's about turning up hungry and desperate to grow and learn. And I think if you've got that in you, then anyone with a risk appetite could be a trader.
I agree.
Now, then for the younger people, because they may think, okay, so I enter this large corporation and whether it's one of the oil majors or some of those traders or the ABCDs, in the beginning you come there, you know nothing, and you sit there on the desk. Even you may be extremely enthusiastic and hungry. How do you then start to make your mark? And if I look back at your career, within 2 years you got promoted, and in 4 years you were in Geneva. I don't recall you at all as a corporate guy. And I wasn't either. And some of the guys that were very successful as traders, they weren't corporate. But what you read online nowadays is that, yeah, okay, in a corporation, you need to behave in a certain way or, you know, be political and you need to understand the corporate sensitivities. What is your advice as a trader to make your mark?
Well, I've always gone from be direct and speak the truth, let the cards fall where they may. That largely depends on the quality of management above you. And like I said, I was very fortunate when I was at BP to have some very good managers, as they were in Cargill. But as my career progressed, it became more important, that style, that kind of quite combative style. And I like to think that when you open your mouth, people knew you actually believed what you were saying at all times. And I think that integrity carries you a long way. If you bump into the wrong manager, that integrity can get you in a lot of trouble. It's not horses for courses. You have to read the room. But I would say as a trader, being forthright and honest lets people know exactly where you are, put you away, your heart on your sleeve. And if you're wrong, you're wrong. Then that's fine, right? We put ourselves in harm's way. That's what we do as traders. You're not going to get it right all the time. And I think this comes on to the mistakes thing. You know, making mistakes and being wrong is a huge part of what we do. And I think, you know, sometimes people think, and I have to respectfully disagree with Mr. Ivo Sorjanovic when he said on the previous podcast, you only get to make one mistake. I'm sorry, Ivo, I don't agree with that. I think you make a myriad of mistakes. And I think if you're pushing hard enough and you're trying new things and you're trying to be creative, those mistakes will happen more often. And that's okay. As long as you stop, the losses are moderated and you understand why you've done it and you learn from it, then like I said earlier on, they're not really mistakes, they're investments in the future. So making mistakes is all part of what you do. But again, it depends on what kind of manager you have. You have to have a manager that understands that trading is about making mistakes. And without, you know, you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs. And that's why I believe that trading teams need to be managed by traders. I think you have to understand the nature of the process. You have to understand the fallibility of the people involved. You have to understand biases. You have to be able to challenge at good times and bad. And they have to believe you've got their back when things go wrong, they cannot be training successfully with the sword of Damocles over their head, just waiting for someone to trip up and then they're gone. You know, you have to build trust with them. And with that means going through their successes and going through their failures and treating them both the same in terms of learning opportunities. So I think being forthright has stood me in good stead. But like I said, but luckily I bumped into a couple of good managers who could cope with that. I have seen some managers who wouldn't respond quite so well.
Hey, related to what we're just discussing, being surrounded by really the best people in the industry and learning from them and learning from the mistakes that you're able to make. Now, and also going back to this COVID period, but then another angle is that everyone was sitting at home all of a sudden. And from 2020 to 21, you had this thing which was called the gamification of finance. And it was a combination of new technology, like all kinds of people who could via Robinhood or other platforms could all of a sudden, within brackets, I would say, trade or maybe gamble or speculate from their phones. And it concentrated first on, say, digital assets, but also the stock market, where you had GameStop. And now even I see every once in a while, I see developments that they also want to open commodities and not only ETFs, but like OTC products or for retail. Now, what is your view to that? So opening up trading like professionals do to retail, do you think that's a good thing? That's a normal, natural development of technology and free markets? Or do you think it's not a good idea at all?
It's a great thing for the existing players.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not a level playing field. When I was doing oil for Cargill, it was not a level playing field with BP, you know, and I had to fight tooth and nail every day, every week to try and access that information, meet people, talk to people, work twice as hard as other people just to get some semblance of a level playing field. If a retail consumer thinks he can walk into the bean market or the oil markets and be regularly successful, it's like walking into a casino. He might have some fun, but in the long term, if he's making money, he should be working for Vitor. We talk about trading, and I think we always come back to this sort of flat price. Is it going up? Is it going down? And I actually have a bit of an issue with the way we use the word trader, because I think it sort of covers a whole gamut of things that maybe your listeners don't quite understand necessarily. It's like calling a banker without any sense of understanding about what in investment banking he or she might be doing. I mean, you've got the flat price derivative trading and options trading, which is kind of what I was doing. But there's global arbitrage, there's commodity arbitrage, there's temporal arbitrage, there's asset trading, there's option trading within a portfolio, physical optionality. So when you speak to traders, a lot of people will say, I'm a trader. But they'll look nothing and sound nothing like the kind of people that most people associate with the trader. And I think it's really important that people understand that, you know, image of a trader, and I think this podcast is about accessibility of the oil markets and letting people understand the commodity markets a bit better. I think the misnomer that you have to have red braces and shout a lot to be a commodity trader is so far from the truth, I can't tell you. And I always equate, you need alphas in your team. You need these shouty people, aggressive people in your team, but you have to balance them with people who play the game differently to you. And I think, to use a footballing terminology, right, if you have a football team with 11 strikers, you're going to lose almost every game, yeah? If you have 11 goalkeepers, you're not going to score many goals. But by having a different stretch of people at the organization doing different things, some doing global arbitrage, some doing temporal arbitrage, some doing physical, some doing options, some doing derivative trading, some speculating on flat price, some doing the analytical trading. If you have that, then you know you can almost, with good people, you can almost be sure that you're going to have a successful team, irrespective of the kind of markets, because some markets will suit goalkeepers and some markets will suit strikers. And if you've got a team full of strikers, they might do well for a few years and then they'll find themselves in a defensive kind of market and they're in a world of pain. So I think it's important that people understand traders come in lots of different shapes and sizes, and don't look at yourself and go, I'm not a trader because I don't look like this, because I've seen every color, shape and creed of trader, and it doesn't define how good you are or how successful you are.
What you describe is the reason why we started the podcast. It's fantastic. It's great. Marketing.
I think
it's really well articulated, and it's exactly why we wanted to do it, to show the different types of traders and this whole nonsense about the market is going up or going down is a tiny bit.
Within BP, in my group at least, spending time on flat price movements was one of the last things to do in the day. We had a myriad of trading opportunities around the world to look at, and we were better at than telling you where the price of crude oil was going to go. That was literally number 10 or number 20 on the list of things to do, because we were better at it. It more suited our information flow. The geopolitical implications of flat price oil are very difficult to understand. And the money flows in and out of oil sometimes have nothing to do with the price of oil. So I think sometimes if you get too ingrained in the physicality or the physical nature of the product you're trading, you look at it, the fundamentals are weakening, you think the price needs to go down. Well, that's not always the case, right? So I think, you know, if you're talking about trading, I think people need to understand that there are several or multiple facets to it. And flat price trading is only one tiny part of it.
Really cool, Rob. And I think that's a great end to this podcast. It's also great to hear that you actually still trade. But then for yourself, I think we didn't speak to anybody yet that actually does that, or maybe they didn't confess it yet. But I really appreciate sharing your story and how you look at it. Many thanks. Loved it.
You've exceeded my expectations. I thought it was amazing. I think it's good to see you, that you're happy, and you articulated really well also how I think about many things, and Alex and I think about what we wanted to show to the audience who is interested in commodities and in trading. So fantastic. Thanks a lot, Rob.
My pleasure. Thanks for talking to me, guys. Take care.
Have a great day. Yeah?